This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Candace Millard is back with a book that critics already are saying is destined to become yet another of her bestsellers. This one is River of the Gods, Genius, Courage, and Betrayal in the Search for the Source of the Nile, and it's being published today. The book chronicles the death-defying journeys of three men determined to solve a mystery that had perplexed explorers for centuries, and that is the location of the Nile River's headwaters. Along the way, they survived spears that cut through their faces, beetles embedded in ears, illnesses that left them paralyzed for months and near death. And what characters they are. Richard Francis Burton, for instance, was a master of more than two dozen languages. He was a skilled swordsman and fascinated by the sexual practices of just about everybody on Earth. Candace Millard is also the author of New York Times bestsellers The River of Doubt, Destiny of the Republic, and Hero of the Empire, and she lives here in the Metro. Candace, welcome back. So good to have you here again.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve. It's great to be back.
You know, why was finding the source of the Nile so difficult? Because wouldn't these explorers just walk alongside the river until they found its starting point?
You'd think so. Yeah, as you say, people have been trying to find it for really millennia. Egyptian kings, ancient philosophers and historians trying to figure out where it was. But it's more than 4,000 miles long. It's the longest river in the world, the most storied river in the world. And people thought, okay, we'll start at the Mediterranean Sea and we'll ascend it. We'll go south. But they again and again quickly got mired in these enormous, enormous swamps and never got anywhere near it.
And they had to actually change their tactics at some point and stop that route. And they came in from the east, right?
Right. Finally, in the 19th century, these two German missionary explorers had this insight, and they believed that instead of a giant desert in the interior of East Africa, there was a huge, huge inland sea. And so they thought, okay, what we need to do is we need to start well below the equator on the east coast and go inland. And lucky for them, they had Zanzibar just off of the coast where they could sort of regroup and get all of their supplies and go from there.
And these explorers, we should point out, weren't exactly welcomed by the natives for good reason.
For very good reason. For so long, so I first heard the story 20 years ago when I was at National Geographic, and at that time, everyone thinks of, oh, these brave European explorers, and they were brave, and they were insane, and this was incredibly dangerous, but obviously, this is a place where millions of people have lived for hundreds of thousands of years, and these people were not invited, and they posed immediate danger, but absolutely long-term danger, as we later learned.
So the natives sensed the potential for things going wrong for them with these strangers coming in their midst.
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, these are many different groups of people. It's an enormous continent. And they obviously were fighting with each other at times as well. So they absolutely understood danger. And they had been dealing with Arabs for a long time, coming in, getting ivory, getting enslaved people.
You know, why was the idea of finding the source of the Nile such a big deal to begin with here? Because why had so many explorers spent so much time trying to find it?
Well, it's interesting, especially in the Victorian age. So people before had been obsessed with Greece and Rome and learning those languages and that history. And then at the end of the 18th century, they found the Rosetta Stone. And then everyone became obsessed with Egypt, because here is an even richer and even older civilization. And the Nile, you wouldn't have Egypt without the Nile, right? It brings life to this very desert-like region. And so it brings life, it brings beauty, it brings this civilization. What would happen if we didn't have it? Where does it begin? That's an obvious question, and it's obvious to human nature. We want to learn, we want to understand, especially these things that are so central to our lives.
I mean, what difference would it make to humankind to know where the source of that river was?
Well, again, I think it's just human nature.
You know,
we ask those. Yeah, you want to know. You want to ask those questions. And also, what if it stops?
Yeah.
That's the danger. Just think of all the death that it would bring if we didn't have the Nile River. So we need to understand where it comes from.
You know, there's this group that shows up throughout the book that winds up playing a big role, a chief motivator, if you will, in these with these adventurers. And that organization was the Royal Geographical Society, a big deal during the 1800s. What was that group and what did it do?
So it was founded in 1830, and it quickly became the most respected, most powerful scientific institution in the UK or in England. And so it had everyone. Charles Darwin was a member. David Livingstone was a member. And so it was very highly, highly respected. And obviously, the British Empire at that time is looking to expand. And the way to expand is to go into these unknown to European lands and, start to map and find out what the resources are.
And it's kind of amazing because these days we know where everything in the world is, but back in the 1850s, 1830s, there were still places we hadn't discovered yet.
Huge expanses of land that hadn't been, again, quote unquote, discovered, where many, many people had lived for a long time. But to the Western world, it was completely unknown and it was absolutely irresistible.
Google Maps wasn't available back in the 1830s.
It was not. No, it was much more difficult.
No drones, nothing like that. Yeah.
It was more difficult, but it was also more exciting. You know, it was this thrill of adventure, the thrill of the unknown, which we have today in space. We have maybe the deepest reaches of the ocean, you know, in our own minds. I mean, there are still these places that we still have to discover, but our own lands, not so much.
What captured your interest in this story as much as it did?
Well, so again, I first heard the story 20 years ago. I worked at National Geographic magazine for a number of years, and I knew it as the story again of adventure, of an insane danger, of these two men who were very, very different, and their friendship and the betrayal of that friendship. And it really captured my imagination, and I just kind of thought about it over the years. But then when I did some research, I wasn't sure I wanted to write about this, though. But I started doing research, and I found Sidi Mubarak Bombay, who really did more to map his continent than any European who came into it. And so I thought, this is a story I want to tell.
He's the unsung hero of this book.
He is. So Sidi Mubarak Bombay, he was kidnapped as a child from his village in East Africa.
I mean, this is an unbelievable life story.
It's unbelievable. See, he was dragged to the coast and then taken to Zanzibar, where he was sold for cloth when he was just a child. And then he was taken to Western India, where he was enslaved for 20 years. And when the man who owned him died, he made his way back to East Africa, which was where he met Burton and Speke, these two British explorers. And he went with them on this long journey. And again, they spend years traveling for thousands of miles. And they go to Lake Tanganyika, and then he goes with Speke to the Nyanza, which is the source of the Nile, which Speke then named Lake Victoria. He then later went back with Speke and Grant. He went with Henry Morton Stanley when Stanley found David Livingstone, you know, Dr. Livingstone,
I presume. Yeah.
That was Bombay, taking him back to Lake Tanganyika. And then he became, with Vernie Lovett Cameron, the first man to cross the entire continent from east to west, sea to sea. So he was incredibly well-traveled and made an enormous contribution to the mapping of East Africa.
Candace Millard is my guest. Her new book, River of the Gods, Genius, Courage, and Betrayal in the Search for the Source of the Nile. She'll be appearing in town at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. That's Wednesday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information can be found at rainydaybooks.com or by calling 913-384-3126. As you have in the past, you and your husband travel to the setting of this book, and once again, you managed to find your life in peril. What happened?
So I've been planning this trip for a long time, and I finally was able to do it, you know, with my kids and my parents helping, blah, blah, in February of 2020. So first of all, not really knowing that things were really going to get out of hand quickly.
With COVID.
With COVID, right? Yeah. And so I went to Kenya, Zanzibar, Tanzania, and Uganda. And it was just an incredible, incredible trip. It was just as amazing as you can imagine. But when I was on Lake Tanganyika, which is one of the largest lakes in the world and one of the deepest, we were in just a small open boat, a wooden boat, and there had been a huge storm. And so it was tipping like crazy. I mean, I thought, and it took us hours to get to this other side. And I thought, you know, we're going to tip over, we're going to fall out, and we'll never make it. And I said to my husband, you know, there's no way we could swim to the coast. And he said, you know, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. The crocodiles will eat us before we get there. So, and because it was filled with crocodiles.
And weren't you, like, was it in South America when you were in a small airplane and the airplane's motor cut out and you sort of had that moment where you thought, this is it?
Yeah, I was in the Brazilian Amazon in a single-engine plane, and that one engine cut out, and we very nearly died.
You know how to pick them, don't you? Yeah. Why do you make it a point to visit some of the places that you write about, Candace? What do you get from actually going to these places?
So there's nothing better than going into an archive. I love, you know, I'm a research nerd, I guess. I love working in libraries and working in archives, but also to go and to see these places, to smell them, to hear them, really makes a huge difference in your writing. For instance, when I was writing my first book set in the Amazon, one of my main questions were, how were these men starving to death? I mean, this is Theodore Roosevelt, right? The quote-unquote great hunter, and he was with someone who had spent his life mapping the Amazon. This is the richest ecosystem in the world. And you understand right away when you go, because it's absolutely silent and you see nothing. You are being eaten by every insect imaginable, but anything that you can eat, good luck finding it. And the answer is evolution. You know, everything has evolved to either be a predator or not be prey.
Wow, interesting. You write, you wrote so much of this book during COVID, and it's probably only fair to point out that you have three kids. I'm just guessing that those two things managed to pose a challenge to getting this book, River of the Gods, put out.
They did. You know, it's funny, a lot of my friends or people who don't live here and don't really know what my life is like were like, oh, this is great. You know, you'll really be able to hunker down. And I was like, I have three kids at home. No, and obviously it's wonderful and I want to spend that time with them. But yeah, good luck getting anything done. So it definitely slowed it down.
How did you manage that?
You know, you just find time where you can, you know, when they were doing online school. And so I would squirrel away in my office. And I did get lucky in that I was able to get all the research that I needed before everything shut down. So I had all the material. I just needed to be able to organize it and start writing.
And your process, if I remember correctly, is you like to outline and outline in detail before you actually sit down and actually begin writing the book.
Right. I spend more time organizing an outline than writing. So
and that's the challenge then.
And that's the challenge. But I love it. I always say, because a lot of people think, oh, I hate to outline. It's so boring and tedious. But it's really like working a puzzle. If you like a puzzle, and you can't, to me at least, the kind of writing that I do, you can't do it without an outline, because you have to be able to move things around. And once you start writing, it's very difficult to do that.
And when you outline, do you actually do it the old traditional way? Are you using the Roman numerals and letter A and B and all that thing, or do you have your own Candace Millard kind of method?
I do it, yeah, the old-fashioned way. I just do it on a Word document. I'm super, super old school. I'm old and old school.
So. Aren't we both, yeah. Where did you find the source material for this book?
So most of it I found in the UK at the Royal Geographical Society in London, the Royal Adriatic Society, the British Library, the Library of Scotland, National Library of Scotland, Edinburgh. There are some archives in Zanzibar. I was able to work with some people who helped me with that. So yeah, it was a little bit of everywhere. And there's, I won't say what it is, but the story builds up to this shocking, tragic event. And I was able to go where that event took place, which is just outside of Bath. And where it happened, the same family owns that land. And they gave me a tour and gave me a piece of where it happened.
Wow.
So, yeah, the whole experience was incredible. And I have to admit that when I'm choosing a topic, there are a lot of things that go into committing before I commit to an idea. And one is, oh, I'll get to travel to this incredible place. I'll get to go to East Africa. I'd been to Ethiopia with National Geographic, and I really wanted to go back. So that obviously definitely factored in.
I was going to say, what do you need to make a book project go? Because the Star's Dan Kelly just did a story on you over the weekend, and he pointed out that you've actually abandoned books on Marie Curie and Benjamin Franklin because you got to a point even months into your research where you realized this wasn't quite working for you.
That's right. Marie Curie was a real heartbreak for me. I worked on it for about a year.
Yeah.
Her personal story is incredible. It's incredibly inspirational and just fascinating. And I really, really wanted to write about her. And there is quite a bit of source material. In fact, her papers, they're still sort of radioactive. You have to sign a liability waiver to work with them.
Okay.
But the problem with her is that the action takes place in her mind. You know, I mean, I was looking for a story that I could tell. It obviously would have to be about the discovery of radium, but I couldn't just keep saying, well, she's still in her laboratory. She's still there. She's still working. You know, she had two dresses, a black and a dark blue, that she would wear in the laboratory and she would wear to accept the Nobel Prize. And she's still in her black dress working in the laboratory. You need, for the kind of writing that I try to do, you need action, you need events, you need things to be moving forward.
And you couldn't
physically
find that with her.
I couldn't find it. Yeah, it is a great, great story. And there are biographies, you know, cradle to grave biographies of her, but that's not what I do. And so I just couldn't make it work.
Best-selling author Candace Millard is my guest. Her new book, River of the Gods. You know, I didn't realize this, but there were so many expeditions to find the source of the Nile, Candace. Why did you decide to focus on the Burton Speke Bombay journeys? Why them?
Because I found them so fascinating, these particular characters. And they're really the ones who, in the end, did find it. I mean, Speke, it was kind of dumb luck, but he was the one who did find Lake Nyanza. The Nyanza. And so, but, you know, again, Burton and Speke. So Burton is, as you said, this absolutely brilliant character. He's written dozens of books.
You could not have invented him if you were a fiction writer.
You couldn't. But he's brilliant and accomplished, but he's always been an outsider, right? So he was born in England, but grew up on the continent. And to many people, he doesn't even look British, right? He's black hair, black mesmerizing eyes.
Yeah.
And even his teeth, you know, Bram Stoker, who would go on to write Dracula, met Burton and was obsessed with him and describes his teeth looking like gleaming daggers. So they think that he could have been the inspiration for Dracula. And then you have John Hanning Speke, who's his complete opposite. He's what the British expected their heroes to be, right? So he had born into the aristocracy. He was a lieutenant in the British Army. He loved to hunt.
Yeah.
But he was burning with this sort of quiet, unspoken ambition. And he admired Burton. But as we know, often admiration can easily turn into envy, can turn into resentment, and can turn into hate. And that's what happened here. And this hate, this burning, festering bitterness destroyed them both in the end.
You know, much of what people should know about Richard Francis Burton can be had by knowing about his harrowing journey to Mecca, disguised as a Muslim, no less. This is something no Englishman had ever done when he did it. And he put his life on the line, of course, to do this. His preparations were beyond meticulous. He went so far as to be circumcised, not as was done to Jewish men, but as was done according to Arabic rite.
Right.
I mean, wow.
Yeah, he was incredible, and he immersed himself. He obviously spoke Arabic very, very well. He seriously studied Islam. He knew a quarter of the Quran by heart.
He changed the tone of his skin. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. Walnut juice.
Yeah.
But he. But the thing about Burton is he studied obsessively. Studied every culture, every religion, and respected none. So he understood why this is important. He understood why Mecca is a forbidden city, and he understood the religion, and he didn't care. He wanted to go in, and that was his story again and again and again. I always say he was an equal opportunity offender.
And then on one of his journeys, finding the source of the Nile, he survives a javelin to his face. It actually went through his cheeks, I think.
That's right. So they were in what was then known as Somaliland, and again, uninvited, definitely a potential threat.
Yeah.
And one night, their campsite was attacked. One of his friends, one of the members of the expedition, was killed. Speke was stabbed 11 times.
Yes.
It's really incredible that he survived. And Burton, yes, had a javelin thrust through his jaw from side to side. And it left this really great jagged scar down his face that made him seem even more dangerous and suspicious to Britons.
And then Speke is the one who winds up surviving a beetle that had it crawled in his ear. And I'm kind of bummed that Scott Simon of NPR's Weekend Edition asked you about this first, because I wanted to get there first. What happened?
So one night there's a huge storm and Speke's tent is knocked down. And so he lights a candle. It's pitch, pitch black outside. He lights a candle to try to erect his tent, but it brings in this horde of hundreds of beetles, and he flails away and he tries to get rid of him and he can't. He finally gives up and he lies down to try to get some sleep, and one of the beetles crawls into his ear and he can't get it out, and he can feel it burrowing deeper and deeper, and it's driving him insane. So he tries butter, he tries oil, everything he can think of, and he finally, out of desperation, takes his penknife and jabs it in his ear. And yeah, he kills a beetle, and for weeks after, like, bits of wing and leg come out in the earwax. But it unfortunately deafened him for the rest of his life in that ear.
So there's Burton, there's Bombay, and there's Speke. And I'm wondering, which of these men would you most like to have lunch with tomorrow?
Absolutely Bombay. There's no question.
Yeah, no question.
No question.
It.
Yeah, I mean, not only was he fascinating and did he travel so much of Africa, but he was an incredibly kind person, incredibly generous. That's what astonished me, that after surviving so much loss, so much tragedy, he emerged with this unbelievably big heart, soft and kind and generous human being. And people say that again and again, because he traveled again with so many explorers, and everyone says that of him. And I just find that astonishing. And you can see it in the picture of him. You can see it in his face.
You know, over the course of this book, Candace, there's lots of confusion over where the true headwaters of the Nile actually are.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, how did they determine whether they were in the right place or not?
So they had a lot of scientific instruments that they used, but they really relied on local informants. They talked to people who live there. And as so often happens, they, at the same time that they're completely relying on the people who live there to give them accurate information, the people at home, the armchair geographers, the gentleman scientists, always poo-poo that, of course you can't trust the people who live there to know what they're talking about. And so the explorers would take that information and make it seem like, oh, yeah, no, this was just for me. I'm not obviously listening to anyone who lives there.
You were talking about the tension between Speke and Burton, and at one point the question of whether Speke had arrived at the source of the Nile caused tensions with Burton, because he didn't believe him.
He didn't believe him. So what happened is that at that point, Burton was so ill, he had malaria. He hadn't been able to walk for nearly a year. He was paralyzed. And they're trying to make their way back to the coast. They've been to Lake Tanganyika. And Speke says they had heard of this even larger lake. And Lake Victoria, or the Nyanza, it's the second largest lake in the world. It's the largest lake in Africa, second largest freshwater lake in the world. It's absolutely mind-bendingly enormous. And so Speke had seen it, and he hadn't traveled. He was there for 2 days. I mean, he was in the southern reaches, and the Nile comes out in the north. He hadn't made any scientific measurements or anything like that, but he just felt like he knew it. And he told Burton, and he was really offended when Burton was like, well, maybe, we'll see. You know, we have to do more research. And he was infuriated that he didn't immediately believe him.
The book is River of the Gods, Genius, Courage, and Betrayal in the Search for the Source of the Nile. I think you've got another winner here. Congratulations.
Thank you so much,
Always
Steve.
Good to have you here.
It was really fun.
Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.